Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the sovereignty of all First Nations people all around the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening via our website as well, 989fm.com.au, welcome to you as well. It's really good to have your company on this Friday morning. What a good day. I love Fridays. Tiger is actually on the way to the Bowie Muster out Bow Desert. So I'm taking over this morning. And we've got a really interesting guest actually, and talking about a topic that I think is really important in Aboriginal affairs. So we're talking to Aboriginal health specialist Deborah Hocking, and she's been on the program a couple of times before. We've got her on the line at the moment. Deborah, welcome to the program. How are you?
Hi, Amy. I'm really well, thank you. And you?
I'm getting there. I've got a bit of a cold, unfortunately,
but
hopefully I won't spread it around the radio station. But first of all, can you tell us where's your country and who's your mob?
My mob are the Muwinina people of southeast Tasmania. That's where my country is. It's a fairly big region. And one thing, can I just comment on that? That only just a few weeks back, we had our land handed back to us, and we're now traditional owners of our land. Yeah.
What was that under the land rights system down in Tasmania, or native title?
No, it was under the Indigenous Land Corporation actually bought it for us, and 15 years ago, and we clearly, you know, have looked after it and regenerated it, and so we had the deeds handed back to us, so it belongs to us now.
That's such good news. It's great to hear, especially down in Tassie as well, that there's still other avenues you can fight for land rights, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It was it was a landmark, you know, sort of thing, and so we, it was a big long haul for all of us, but you know, we hung in there, and see what happens when you hang in there, hey?
Definitely. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and your story, because you are actually the work you're in now is very much informed from your early history, isn't it, growing up as a child and being a member of the Stolen Generations?
That's right, Amy. I mean, I you know, down in Tasmania, it was not unlike any other state or territory around the country where, you know, on racial grounds, children were removed. And again, Tasmania was no different. So back in 1959, myself and my siblings were removed from my mum, and we're all split up. And I was 18 months at the time, so, you know, clearly I don't have any memory of that. But what was to follow, you know, the years to follow, I certainly do have memory. And, you know, it was really hard growing up in a family that you didn't know. And, you know, all of a sudden you're placed with these people that, you know, want to take over your life and discard your own parents. And I couldn't, I always ask, where's my real mum and dad? And you know, the only thing I was told was, well, look, they're not any good, and we can look after you better.
And I'm guessing these were non-Aboriginal people as well. Were you told that you were an Aboriginal child?
No, not initially. It wasn't until a few years later. But, you know, bearing in mind also that this family were chosen because they were Christians, you know. And, you know, I very quickly sort of came to wonder about the church. What kind of people go to church and then do these things, you know, do this abuse and stuff like that? And there were a lot of unanswered questions that I had growing up. And, you know, the yearn to see my own family was just abominable. I was miserable. And but, you know, I had to survive and survive the abuse and stuff like that. But I never ever stopped wanting to find them. You know, but I knew that I couldn't do it as a child because, you know, the authorities made damn sure that, you know, once you were taken, that was it. No more contact.
And when did you start to piece together that early history? You're only 18 months when you were taken off your family. What was the genesis of you being able to find out the reasons why you were taken from your parents?
Oh, look, do you know what, to this day, you know, it's not really clear why I remained in this foster home when my other siblings were returned. back. My mother was told that when she could, be a fit mother, don't you hate that?
What does fit mother mean, God?
Oh, exactly. Well, I read the welfare reports, and they were hideous. It was like there was washing all over the lounge room. The children had nothing on their feet. There was a box of matches in the wrong place, and they considered that neglect. You know, if you walk into anybody's home now, that's standard pretty much, isn't it? I mean, it was just the reasons they gave for removal was just amazing. And today I don't understand how that could have happened.
That's very much a racialized view, isn't it? The view of neglect. And I think that's what gives people like conservatives like Andrew Bolt and Keith Winchell this sort of ammunition to say, well, it was for the child, the safety of the child that they were removed because it was about neglect, not race. But I see that as them seeing an Aboriginal mother and interpreting it in their own way, wasn't it? It very much was a race issue.
Yeah, but the one thing that astonished me in the reports was never once did it say, but the children are happy, because the children were happy. Yeah. My older siblings were happy. There was no danger. I found that quite interesting. And over the years, my mum, I still have the letters now, wrote to the authorities begging for me to be returned back. And, I've read those out on national TV, and it's really heart-wrenching stuff. Left a lot of questions to me, and how do you survive in a world where it's been turned around, you don't know who you are. But it was in later years that I did find out my heritage, and it was just amazing when I connected back with my family when I was 20. We sat down and we talked about it, and it was just amazing. It was like nothing new to me. It was like, and so over the years, there's been a lot of recovery, Amy, and a lot of forgiveness, trying to understand how these things can happen. And look, if you listen to stories of stolen generations around the country, it is heart-wrenching. And when I tell my story internationally, there's a look of disbelief. It's like, in Australia? Yeah. Really? Yep, in Australia. And I try to be a role model in some way, saying, look, I've had adversity all my life and tragedies, and so have many of us. But I say to the young ones, with the right guidance and mentorship and the right role models, we can get through this. And recognise the part that trauma plays in our lives, and particularly for Aboriginal people, it's compound trauma. It's not just one trauma. It's the loss of land, the loss of identity, culture, language, and so on. Each one of those is a layer of trauma. It's a layer of loss, and for stolen generations, that's an extra layer as well. So how do you deal with that? The federal government, over the years, we've been having this conversation with them, because most of us know and see the trauma every day. It manifests itself in family violence, in drug and alcohol misuse, and many other things, incarcerations, which we all know are not the same as mainstream.
Yeah.
Five times higher, six times higher. And so we've been saying to the federal government, look, you've got to look at causative factors. You can't keep putting band-aids on things and addressing the primary health when there's so much underlying that's causing it. But the thing is, we didn't have evidence, and of course that's what they wanted. Oh, you don't have any evidence of this. It's all, circumstantial. It's like, okay, so now we have the evidence.
When you talk about trauma and you talk about those underlying issues and how it's driving everything, I mean, you talked about a lack of evidence. It's something that a lot of Aboriginal people talk about on a daily basis, just in your daily conversations, how integral trauma is to the situation we find ourselves in now. But I feel like we don't actually understand the actual impacts trauma have, not just on a person, but on children as well, the development of their brain and early childhood development. I mean, what do we mean by trauma and the different types of trauma that are actually currently existing in our communities?
Yeah, well, I think the big one that we want to start talking about is transgenerational trauma. It's a transference of trauma, not deliberately, I have four children and I have transferred my trauma to them. I recognise that. And I think that it's a cycle. It's a cycle that's happening. It's happened for generations. And I think that this is the stuff that we need to talk about. If we can, over time, start reducing that cycle, you know, and so the young ones aren't, it's not impacting on them. You know, and I've worked with many detention centres and juvenile centres around the country, and, you know, the workers say, look, our Aboriginal kids, God, they're so angry.
Yeah.
And they don't even know what they're angry about. And that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about, is that transference of trauma.
Yeah.
And we, you know...
So is that a scientific thing, like phenomenon in the brain that we don't really understand yet, that transferal of trauma along generations? I mean, how does it work?
Well, you know, I mean, the young brain from 0 to 5, you know, the neural responses are just amazing. Just amazing, the things the children can pick up on and sense and all that kind of thing. And even if there's not a deliberate, and there, you know, there isn't, it's not deliberate. You don't intentionally mean to harm your child.
Yeah.
But the way your actions, your behaviours, your way of thinking does impact it, because the children are so impressionable. You know, and if they hear sort of people sitting around saying, oh, look, you know, we're hopeless. What life do we have? We can't even, our life expectancy is no good. You know, children hearing that kind of thing, that actually is a transference of trauma.
Right.
You know, and so it's very impressionable on the young ones. So that's what we want to start addressing. And I say start because it's going to be a long road. It hasn't happened overnight and can't be fixed overnight.
Yeah. And then you've got these compounded traumas, like you were saying before. So
not
only dealing with that transgenerational trauma, but then the causes or the symptoms of that trauma that come out in family violence, like you were saying, and the added trauma that adds onto to the next generation. It's very complex, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, the first 20 years of my, or maybe the first 15 of years of my life, I saw violence that no child should have to see.
Yeah.
You know, it was awful, and not only in the foster home, but other homes I was bounced around to. You know, the family violence was just incredible, and you know, it's almost becoming an accepted part now.
Like, you know, a norm. They talk about it being a norm, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, people are becoming numb to it. And therefore it's getting, I mean, we have communities in crisis with family violence and you know, even the ICE epidemic, you know, all these things that we have to deal with. And I know, you know, some listeners might think, oh God, that's bigger than Ben-Hur. Where do you start? You know, where do you start with all this? Well, I think that the first place to start is to start talking about it and recognising it and owning it. Okay, it's not, it's been inflicted on us for generations now.
And, do we talk about family violence in the right way, though? Because even though it has gotten a lot of media attention, and rightly so, this year, we don't talk about it in a trauma context.
No.
It's really only Aboriginal communities who do that, but from a policy perspective and a media perspective, we never mention trauma in relation to family violence, really.
No. And that's the conversation that has to start happening, you know, because I think, you know, I've spoken to the PMC's office a few weeks ago. All the senior policy analysts from around the country were invited in, and I told them about that they're going to start using rolling trauma into their policies.
Oh, great.
I know. And I thought, well, okay, you're all nodding at me and saying, what a great idea, but let's see the proof.
Well,
you know,
I would agree, because you look at sort of how disempowering a lot of these, a lot of the trauma comes from this real severe sense of disempowerment of our people. For example, taking away a child and having no ability to get that child back. And so you see them in their child removal policies or their incarceration policies, and then they say, oh no, we're going to recognise trauma. It doesn't really fit up in their actual huge policy perspective when it comes to Aboriginal affairs, because ultimately it's about disempowerment. I mean, don't those two just completely clash?
Yeah, they sure do. You're so right. Yeah, absolutely right. And so, you know, this course that we're rolling out through the University of Wollongong, it's been developed by Aboriginal people You know, it's wholly and solely Aboriginal owned.
Yeah.
But having said that, you know, it's open for all, because we believe that, you know, it shouldn't be, you know, sectionized, because there's a lot of our people see mainstream doctors. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, we can't sort of say, well, no, it's only for Aboriginal people. This is something we need to work at together. It's going to be hard for mainstream people to get their head around this. We can do it. You know, many people I speak to around the country say, yeah, I get it. It's been going on for years. It's like, yep. But, you know, the course is open to all, because I think that, you know, we can't, you know, sort of say, well, only us have the understanding, but it will be Aboriginal run, and that's a really important thing. So it's, you know, we'll be the teachers and others will be the learners.
You mentioned I read one of the articles, and there's been a couple articles about this course that you're running in the mainstream media, which is, I think, is really good. And you mentioned that Aboriginal trauma is very different from traumas that maybe non-Indigenous Australia experience. How different is it, would you say, and why does it need that different approach that you guys are outrolling in this course?
Well, I think, you know, if you take it back to colonisation, Amy, and I know I sometimes get a roll of the eyes when I say that word, but, you know, really, if you think about it from colonisation, if you think about the things that have been afflicted on Aboriginal people that have not been afflicted on non-Aboriginal people,
yeah.
You know, the White Australia policy, the child removal policy, all these policies, were they there for white people? No.
Yeah.
No, they won't. So, you know, that's the traumas that differs us from mainstream people, is that they've not had this history that we have, you know, and the compound traumas, you know. I mean, has their culture been taken away? Have they been stopped from speaking their language? No, no. So, you know, it is different trauma. And that has to be recognised too. You know, I know health professionals say, oh, yes, but we all have trauma. We certainly do. But can you tell me that you've had traumas like this?
And it's even the way you respond to trauma, isn't it? I feel like Aboriginal communities often, for example, the anger you were talking about, you actually respond to new traumas that happen in a very different way to maybe a non-Indigenous person might, stemming from your background, which I think feeds into a lot of the racism that's currently existing, a lot of the stereotypes that people try and break.
Yeah, look, you're exactly right. And so, you know, it has to be recognised. And not only, but we have to own our trauma. We have to recognise it and we have to understand it and stop beating ourselves up saying, oh, look, you know, I'm a terrible person, I've done this and I've done that. You know, chances are it's stemming from your unresolved trauma.
Yeah, right. Do people want to get help? I mean, is there enough avenues for blackfellas in communities to be able to access trauma recovery?
Well, that's another underpinning thing with this course, is that, you know, the outcomes will be that people will walk away with new knowledge and understanding, and hopefully take it back to their community, practice, family, you know, or whatever their environment is. That is our hope, and there will be longitudinal evaluations done, follow-ups, to see how people are going back in their communities. But what I want the participants to do is, before they leave the two-week intensive, is to have a plan of what this knowledge, how they're going to roll it out in their environment, whether it be a community or practice or whatever. So, you know, it really is, it's a thought-provoking thing. And, you know, so with the blackfellas that come and do it, you know, we say to them, okay, you're going to go back to your community now. What you've learned here, the knowledge and experience that you've had, how are you going to take that back into your community?
Yeah.
How's that going to make a difference?
What sort of people have you got actually signing up and applying for this course?
Oh, look, a cross-section, I have to say. I would say, you know, with the enrolments that I'm getting, I would say probably 80% are Aboriginal.
Yep. Which is a good thing, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but a cross-section of professionals, of lawyers, doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, Aboriginal health workers, Aboriginal counsellors. So, you know, it's not designed to be to target anyone specific. It's open to everybody. And the thing that I've done with this is, you know, rather than when you do the course, you know, how many times do our mob, you know, you get a certificate of participation. It's like, yeah, no, that's got to stop, you know, and recognise and skill people up and accredit them for their skills that they've learnt. So, you know, they will come in perhaps with no degree at all and walk out with a postgraduate degree.
Why has it taken so long, do you think, to have an actual Aboriginal-controlled and Aboriginal-led and Aboriginal-devised trauma recovery course? It seems like such an essential and important and critical thing, but it's only now that you're actually rolling out the first one in Australia.
Yeah, and that's a valid question too. You know, I've had it asked many times, you know, why haven't we done this stuff before? You know what? We weren't ready before.
Right, yeah.
I believe. I don't think we, you know, had the understanding that we have now. And again, you know, we've had Aboriginal researchers on this and now we have the evidence. And, yeah, we could go off and do something that we, you know, let's face it, to get government dollars, you have to have the proof.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And so the Federal Health Minister has given us $200,000 for scholarships to enable people financially to attend that may not have the kind of money required to do a university degree. And so I think that in itself sends a bit of a message through from the federal government, like I think they're finally starting to get it.
I would hope they are.
Oh, and it's been how many years? You know, but again, there is timing for these things. They need to evolve. They need to, you know, there has to be the right time for it. And I would say the time is now. And if we had done it years ago, maybe we wouldn't have had the knowledge or the understanding that we have now.
Yeah, because I think it's important that we get things right first up, in a sense. We've had, in Aboriginal policy at least, and largely because there's been no blackfellas at the forefront driving it, there's just so many wasted opportunities, aren't they, that just send us backwards. I think it's good we're doing it now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And look, you know, we are doing everything in our possible power to ensure that, you know, the participants who do this will actually walk away thinking, oh my gosh, and have a confidence rather than go back to the community and say, well, yeah, I didn't get much out of that. I'm not sure I can do anything. That's not designed to do that. You know, it's to give people hope and okay. And there'll be lots of storytelling and, you know, interactive stuff. And it's not going to be run like an academic. It's unique. I don't think there's any other degree that sort of quite works like this. But, you know, I must congratulate the University of Wollongong because they have been committed to this all the way through.
Yeah.
And, you know, the things I've asked them to do, like I don't want to restrict people with prerequisites. I want anybody to come and do this.
Yeah, right.
And so the first degree of its kind where you don't actually have to have a prerequisite. So that was good. And we've tried as hard as we can to eliminate all the financial stuff.
Great. That's good.
Yeah, so, I mean, we have the scholarships and we also have Commonwealth-supported places. Now, you know, that means that the federal government also can pay up to 75% of your fees.
That's great to hear. And we might take a break for a song at the moment, but we're going to come back because I really want to ask you about particularly workers in or the people taking this course and how traumatised people themselves can help heal their communities, which I think is really important. So we'll be back in a second. We're going to go to the excellent Thelma Plum, who's sung Father Said.
98.9 FM for the best country.
You're listening to 98.9 Let's Talk, and my guest today is Deborah Hocking, who's rolling out a really important course down in the University of Wollongong, and it's the first Indigenous trauma recovery course in Australia. And Deborah, you mentioned previously that 80% of people who'd applied are Aboriginal. I'm just wondering, with a lot of Aboriginal people, I mean, the majority of blackfellas, I think, dealing with their own traumas, how do we help our communities recover when you might personally be dealing with your own separate trauma or the legacy of that trauma?
No, good question, Amy. Look, what this course is designed to do also is to talk a lot about the concept of self-healing.
Yeah.
You know, because you're right, how can traumatised people help trauma in their community when they're undergoing it. If they haven't had that healing themselves, how can they possibly do it? So this, a lot of this course, as I say, is about self-healing and the different ways that we can, the therapeutic ways that we can do it, because it does start with us. We can't take it forward unless ourselves, you know, we've had that healing.
What do you mean by healing? What sort of practices are involved in healing?
Well, look, healing is different for everybody. If you ask two people what healing is, they'll have two different answers.
Yeah.
Okay, but I guess it is taking us back to a space where we feel strong as Aboriginal people and we acknowledge the hurt and the trauma, but we can overcome it. I have, and many people I know have. And these are the stories that I think are going to be therapeutically great for our community to hear, you know, the good stories. Yes, we have to acknowledge pain and we have to acknowledge a lot of things, but also let's acknowledge what we can do, you know, as Aboriginal people, and that is, you know, getting back to our spirituality, owning ourselves again. That's really important because, you know, I think particularly with a lot of our young men and older men, you know, there seems a loss of you know, their role and, you know, what do we do now? We don't know what to do. So, you know, what we intend to do is to take people back to that spiritual place, maybe as a child or whatever, you know, back to your basics. And sometimes that happens through, you know, telling a personal story can start the healing process. And that story is acknowledged, it's understood, and, you know, I've had people tell me stories that they've never told anybody in their lives. They've had this story inside them, you know, this story of pain and agony.
Yeah.
And, you know, once the storytelling process starts, then, you know, you can start, you know, your healing process by having your story acknowledged. And a lot of stories, you know, aren't told because it's like, oh, look, you know, no one would believe it or who cares or,
yeah.
Well, we do care. We care a lot. And it's, you know, by starting off in that process, there's going to be a lot of storytelling and I think it's such a healing kind of space in itself. But we also talk about, you know, the different ways of self-healing and it is different for everybody. It's not a one size fits all. It's not like that. But we have some really great healers to come along and talk about their experiences and, you know, how offer some choices to people of perhaps, you know, that might not work for you, but have you tried this, you know? So, yeah, you're right. Look, I don't want to be unrealistic here, and you can't say, look, everybody's going to walk away healed.
Yeah.
You know, it's a long road, isn't it? It is a long road, but it's a start, and to start people on that road, it can take years sometimes for that healing to happen. But, you know, to many, they don't know where to start. Just don't know where to start.
What was the starting point for you? Was it finding out about your Aboriginality, going back to country, or what would you say was the turning point for you in starting your journey to healing?
Well, I think finding out about my identity was certainly, you know, the starting place, I'd say. But I knew I had a long, hard road to go. Where do you start? All of a sudden you find out you've got this heritage. Oh, blimey. Where do I go? What do I do? and you know, to some, they don't do anything. It's just too hard. But, you know, I tackled it and I, when I found my family, and I mean, that was hard in itself. It took me 2 years and they only live 5 minutes away from where I lived.
That's amazing.
You know,
God, what a small world.
Oh, isn't it though? But, you know, that was back in the days where there's no freedom of information and, you know, you didn't have access to things that you do now. So, you know, I mean, I did some things I'm probably not all that proud of, but I did them because I was so desperate,
yeah.
You know, to find my family and stuff like that. And I never hurt anybody. I never did anything illegal. Just might have told a few fibs now and then, but, you know.
I mean, I guess people think they're tackling certain issues, but they're really medicating themselves, aren't they? For example, alcohol, drugs, and you mentioned ice before. I mean,
yeah.
I think people think they have a sense of control when really they're using very destructive substances to gain some sort of control.
Well, I think it's about control, but I think it's also about numbness, you know, of the pain is too bad. Anything you can find that's going to take it away. What do you think? you know. I mean, I understand the depth with alcohol and drug use. I mean, I don't use drugs myself, but you know, I have many close people that do, and you know, they are people carrying so much pain. And if you can find something to take that pain away, what are you going to do? You're going to take it.
Yeah,
you know, that's the carrot that is dangled under the nose. You know, you don't want to feel pain anymore. Here, have one of these; it'll take it all away.
And you're talking about more about prescribed drugs now, the way doctors prescribe for depression and things like that.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Right. And you know, I know that medicine has a place in our lives, albeit a small one. I consider. I think that we've got ways that we can tackle things without, you know, having to have a script for it. You know, and I think, you know, and this is my message to mainstream doctors also, is that, you know, stop writing the scripts.
Yeah, right.
Stop it, because you're not doing our people any favours.
Do you see a difference in the way Aboriginal community-controlled health services operate compared to those mainstream health services in relation to Indigenous health and wellbeing? Are they less likely to do that?
Oh, look, definitely. I mean, there's more of a cultural thing with our health services, that's for sure. You know, but then at the end of the day, it's the person's personal choice as to whether they want to use Aboriginal controlled health organisations or whether they want to go mainstream. You know, we can't dictate to people where they should go. And the health controlled organisations around the country do an amazing job. And it's a hard job, and sometimes it's bigger than them.
Yeah, definitely. I could agree. And you mentioned before, I mean, there was a really good article in the Australian, and you talked about closing the gap, and we have all these really horrendous health statistics, you know, and it almost seems like it's intractable that the gap will never close, but you say we need to deal with trauma first.
Yeah.
I mean, so this is just, it's not one siloed issue, isn't it? It affects all health problems, really, that's affecting our communities.
Oh, it absolutely does. And, you know, in the 2015 Prime Minister's Close the Gap report, I'll quote, you know, from that, in many ways we are failing.
Yeah.
Well, yes, you are, because, you know, you're band-aiding things. You can't keep doing that. It's doing our people no favours. It's allowing things to keep manifesting and continuing and cycling and all that kind of thing. So I think, you know, I think now they're at a point where they acknowledge that, you know, what they're doing is not enough.
Yeah.
So hand it over to us.
Yeah. I wish they'd do that in every single area of policy.
Oh, don't we though? I mean, that's exactly right. But I mean, this hasn't just happened overnight, this understanding of trauma. It's been talked about for years, but with the frustrations, like, oh, how do we deal with this?
Yeah.
Well, by talking about it and you know, just keep on, you know, standing up to it and speaking out about it and acknowledging it. And it's not a shame thing. It's not, you know, it's not shameful to be in trauma for excuse me, men or women. It doesn't matter. It's been inflicted upon us, you know, and we're left to deal with it, pretty much.
Yeah, that's very true. And
yeah.
I'm just wondering also, I mean, do we understand, even blackfellas ourselves, do we actually understand trauma? I feel like we almost bandy it around as a concept, but you say that it's been a lot of work done to actually understand it in the way we do now. Do we maybe speak of it as if it's a cliche, we don't really understand what it actually means?
You know, I think in some ways, yes. But in some ways, no. I think that, you know, more and more now there's a growing understanding of it and acknowledgement.
Yeah.
Look, it's like a lot of things, you know, that concepts or things that don't have names. And when they have a name, all of a sudden, it perhaps something like anorexia. Now, you know, that didn't have a name. It was just, you know, you're refusing to eat, you know. The minute it had a name, all of a sudden, there was a new, deeper understanding of it.
Yeah.
And so, and I believe that, you know, by saying the word trauma, we've named it. That's what's causing all our problems.
So it's causing all our problems, you'd say? It's the underlying reason that there's so much sort of disadvantage still in our communities? It all stems back to trauma?
Look, I would say in most cases it causes the despair and the hopelessness and you know, it is so much, people are so heavy. I can physically see people so heavy with it. It's unbelievable. And you know, it does. It's a silent thing. It's not always something you can identify straight away.
Yeah.
You know, it's an experience that you have, and that's, I think, been the whole misunderstanding of what's been going on here. Because mainstream, if I can be respectful here, don't get it.
No, they don't.
And I think a few of your listeners will be saying, yep, they don't get it. Yeah, that's exactly right. So what we have here is a situation where we can take the control.
Yeah.
We can take our lives back. And we don't need help from them. We can do it our way.
Yeah. And I just want to stress, I feel this is a really urgent problem. I mean, we've had Judy Atkinson on a couple of times, and I think she's involved with the course. But she talks about the violence that she is seeing in, and she's been working in this field for, 20 or 30 years. She talks about that violence is the worst she's ever seen. It's a new form of violence. I mean, I think this problem has been just festering along for so long across so many generations. How urgent is it that we need to tackle this right now before things get worse?
Well, Amy, as I said earlier on, you know, we have communities in crisis, absolute crisis. And Judy's right. Judy actually sees it on the front line.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk about
it. You can tell
it
from her voice, actually, that she sees it from the front line. She's very affected by it, I think.
Very affected by it. And, you know, with each experience, you know, we talk about it. You know, she'll debrief with me and you know, both of us just shake our heads. It's like, oh, seriously. And she's right. The violence is at a new level now. So, you know, we need to do something urgently. This is nothing. This is not something that we can say, well, let's just keep an eye on it and see how we go. No. Women are dying. Children are dying.
Yeah.
And if we all can't see that and wake up to it and think, okay, this is not the life that we want to live. We don't want to live and die this way.
Yeah. You mentioned mainstream Australia doesn't understand. I feel like sometimes they make excuses and try and blame it back on Aboriginal communities. There's often, like, every couple of years there'll be a talk, someone speaking about Aboriginal culture is inherently violent and they've always been violent. Is it just this excuse making? It seems to be this unwillingness to deal with this concept of trauma, even from non-Indigenous Australia.
Yeah, well, I think if we take a walk right back and we start looking at the stereotypes that were you know, set in place by mainstream about Aboriginal people, and I can tell you now from talking to my students, I'd hate to say it, but they're still alive and well.
Yeah.
You know, Aboriginal people are always drunk, you know, they don't work, they're lazy, you know, blah. I hear that coming out of my students' mouths. And it shocks me.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, if I said what I really want to say, I probably wouldn't be at the University of Wollongong anymore.
And this is educated kids. They're not just kids, you know, just growing up in certain places. Like, the kids are going to uni, so that's even more shocking to me, I reckon.
Isn't it, though? And you know, it's the racism that I hear. And you think, oh, my goodness, you know. A lot of that is entrenched transgenerationally too.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's passed on through families and you know, I cringe, I absolutely cringe. But at the same time, I don't let it continue. We have a conversation about it and we talk it through. But, you know, that's only a small part of it, you know. But I think the stereotypes that have been, you know, put in place by the media, I have to say, to mainstream media, you know, using the terms of blacks on charges of rape, you know, and that kind of thing. And, you know, I mean, that is so stereotypical. And we've got to try and get negate around that.
Yeah.
We've got to try and say to mainstream, hey, hang on a minute, that is not true. Enough of the lies. Stop it. You know, so, and I think that should fall on all of us to stand up and say, hang on a minute, you know, and we'll come to a space where we can do that. Maybe it's too soon to do that yet, but I believe that, you know, once we start renewing strength and identity in people, that there will be that kind of strength to speak out, and we can be a force to be reckoned with. We may be, you know, a minority population, but by gee, don't underestimate our power.
That's so true. I'm wondering, you talk about paths of healing. At the start of the program, you talked about your people getting your land back under the Indigenous Land Corporation down in Tassie. Now, is that part of healing as well, that connection to land? I mean, how does that make you feel? Does that help in healing, being able to get that land back?
It does. It really does, because land is important to all of us. And, you know, I speak to some people, you know, through my day, and it's like, oh, I was taken from my land. I don't know where my land is. And I think, oh, gosh, what a, you know, awful disconnection that would be, you know, to have that. And isn't it sad to think that some people don't even know where their country is?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and look, LinkUp do a great job, I get that, but we still have so many people walking around this country not knowing their family, their land, their culture, and that is terrible. It breaks my heart to see that. But land is a big part of healing. But okay, sometimes it's for all the, you know, want of trying, some people will never know where their land is. And I think that's really sad.
Yeah, it can. I guess it can compound other things. I guess which adds to the trauma. I guess not having a good sense of where you're from or a good sense of your identity.
Yeah, well, that's right. But don't think, bear in mind, Amy, that there are things that you can reclaim.
Yeah.
You know, it's called cultural renewal, and you know, you can find out about and adapt parts of your culture that, you know, that will restore your identity. You know, I've taught myself my language. Now, I can't speak it prolifically because a lot of it was lost.
Yeah, right.
But when I first started speaking out in Tasmania using my language, one part of the community wanted to hush me up and said, do not speak our language. And I said, no. And they said, no, if you speak it, we'll lose it again. I said, no, we won't. Be proud and then speak our language. Why shouldn't we? You know, we're not living in those days now where, you know, we'll be punished if we speak our language. In fact, what I find that mainstream are particularly interested in all this process. It's like some mainstream, not all. But, you know, it's about reclaiming parts of yourself and maybe not all of that can be put back together again, you know. But even part healing is going to be the assistance, even if you can't fully heal, you know. And that's the thing about, you know, listening to stories, as hard as it is. And we will hear most probably some very, very sad stories.
Yeah.
And but the last thing that I want to do is to re-traumatise people. So that will all be carefully managed in a respectful and a culturally appropriate way.
That's very true. And I think the real thing I like to think about is the children. I think, I guess that can even become a cliche as well. But when we do a lot of these things, it's very much for the children, isn't it?
Yeah.
And trying to stop them inheriting a lot of that trauma. I mean, is there an optimism there that the next generation of children may not deal with some of this trauma that other generations have dealt with?
I think there is some glimmer of hope there.
Yeah.
I've just become a granny for the first time.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And I look at my little grandson and I think, and those out there that have grannies, you know, we look at them and we think, what kind of world are you going to grow up in?
Yeah.
And I guess that, you know, my hope is that, you know, we can start, you know, stopping this cycle of transgenerational trauma, but we have to address it ourselves first. That's the starting point.
I agree. And if people, is the application still open for the trauma recovery program, or how can people get involved, or how can people get in contact if they've been listening and they feel like they want to get involved?
Well, look, we can do it one of two ways. It is on the website. However, as one student said to me the other day, if I wanted a bloody degree in IT, I would have done it. Because it, you know, depends on how savvy you are and what kind of setup you've got. Now, what I say to your listeners, if there is anybody who's particularly interested and don't want to have to go through that whole thing of trying to find on websites and things like that, how about if I give you my direct number? They can get in touch or send me a text and I can send it through to them without them having to go through the whole thing of going from site to site to site to site. You know, I can send them the direct link that will give them information also about the scholarships and about the whole way it's going to work. And then, you know, they can take it from there. But I think, you know, that probably would be easier than just saying, well, just look it up on the website.
Yeah, definitely. And we can put your contact details up on our website to our Facebook as well for people to get in contact if that's all all good with you, because I think there'll be a lot of people out there who will want to actually get involved with what the University of Wollongong's doing. So,
well, you know, that's what we're hoping, and there has been a lot of interest generated, wow, and not only from Australia but also internationally, because it's also offered internationally.
Oh, great.
Mm. So I'm getting different countries interested in it, and of course Canada, dare I say it, you know, who I've spent many times in Canada sitting down with Aboriginal people in Canada, and they are particularly interested. And so it sort of gives an element of, oh gosh, the eyes are watching us, you know, we really, but you know, we will be true to ourselves. We're not going to make any big promises that we can't do.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
It's not about that. And we have the top people like Judy Atkinson, Nye Brown, involved in the faculty. So,
people
can be rest assured that, you know, we're going to give it every damn best shot that we can.
Yeah, and I just want to stress the importance of it. I actually did a couple of trauma courses related to journalism through the Dart Centre earlier this year. So it really opened up my eyes to trauma science and understanding that and how it plays into not just what's affecting our communities but also how it can affect journalism and how we as journalists actually don't do a very good job of reporting it. So
I didn't know that existed. That's amazing.
Yeah, the Dart Centre, and I'm hoping to get some more Aboriginal journalists involved so they understand trauma a bit better, and but also how trauma affects them too, because I think you deal with a lot of things when you report
definitely.
On
I think as journalists, you know, you must sort of see some things and hear stories and witness, and there's got to be some self-care for you guys, hey?
Yeah, well, I'm hoping to, and hopefully we can talk more about that, about how we can collaborate on that.
Yep.
But I really appreciate it. Did you want to tell your listeners your contact details, or you'd like us to put it up on Facebook, or?
Oh, look, I'm happy to share them because, you know, some like to hear a voice on the end of the phone, others it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But I know that those who have contacted me have been very, you know, really thankful that, you know, I've had a personal conversation with them, and I don't mind that at all.
Yeah.
But so how about if I give you my mobile and my email, and if anybody wants to contact either one, that's absolutely fine.
Sounds good. Go for it if you want to tell our listeners. So.
All right. Okay. So mobile is 0417 074696.
Yeah.
And email is all lowercase dhocking at uow.edu.au.
Excellent. And so all of our listeners, if you want to get in contact with Deborah regarding this Indigenous Trauma Recovery course, give her a call or email on that, and we'll also put up her details on our website if you'd like to access that as well. And thank you so much for that this morning, Deborah. It was a really illuminating chat, and we'll definitely have to get you on again soon as well.
Well, thank you, Amy, and thanks for the opportunity, you know, to talk to you guys through, you know, your listeners through you guys. I really appreciate that. And please, you know, if anybody wants to have a chat or whatever, I'm here, you know, just please give me a call or send me an email, and happy to do that.
Excellent. Thanks so much for that, Deborah.
Okay, and Amy, you have a great day.
You too. See you
later. I will. Bye now.
That was Deborah Hocking. She's an Aboriginal health specialist, and she's working at University of Wollongong outrolling a really innovative course around Indigenous trauma recovery. So we'll put up her details online and you can check that out, and also check out our podcast with her a bit later. We're going to leave you with a really with Archie Roach and Paul Kelly, John Pat, and hopefully you have a good weekend, and we'll catch you next Monday.